Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Emily Dufton, the host of this channel, and today we'll be talking to Ido Hartigson, author of the new book, American Trip, Set, Setting, and the Psychedelic Experience in the 20th Century. Hartigson is an assistant professor in the graduate program in Science, Technology, and Society at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Previously, he was a visiting postdoctoral fellow with the Program on Science, Technology, and Society at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and a former journalist. American Trip, released by MIT Press earlier this year, is his first book in English. Ido, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So before we discuss American Trip, you've had a really interesting professional career. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself and how you transformed from a journalist into a professor.
Right. So I've worked as a journalist for many years, though I consider myself, first of all, a writer, and I've been writing ever since I was a kid. And then over the years, switching from writing fiction to writing nonfiction, first as a journalist, and then arriving entering into the academy more seriously, I ended up getting really involved in the subject of psychedelics, both as a scholar as well as an activist in this field and an artist. I've had several projects that I've started over the years, psychedelic video museum online, psychedelic magazine that I've edited. And also my first book, Technomystica, was the first Hebrew book that really got into the subject of psychedelics. And I guess the transition from this more outside the world outside the academy into the academy was just, you know, gradual as I was writing my dissertation and going on that path. And I think it's a transition that I find is both could be frustrating at times when you need to give up some of the liberties that you have as a thinker and as a writer when you're outside the academy. But then on the other hand, it also allowed me to go much deeper than I would have otherwise in this research of the history and the theory of psychedelics, which is something that I'm very grateful for. In that sense, I think for all the criticism that many of us have at times about the academy, that's some kind of gift that it does give you the opportunity to really enter and dive deep into intellectual subjects that I'm very grateful for.
That's fascinating. So you've clearly been interested in studying psychedelics and psychedelia for a long time. Were you always interested in American experiences with psychedelics, or were you focusing on the Israeli experience as well?
So basically, I've started out with this with this whole project, trying to prove some kind of theory in the field of science, technology, and society studies, which is a theory that's called social construction of technology. And it's about how society shapes technologies. And it seemed to me, thinking about the case of LSD in the mid-20th century United States, that was really the ideal or example or instance to take this model, apply it for the case of psychedelics, and also extend it to show that psychedelics are really this kind of quite unique technology that acts differently, that can expand and on this model and add new intricacies into it. So the American story was something that was, for this reason first, very interesting to me. But then at the same time, you know, I've always been fascinated by American culture, and particularly taken with the 1960s decade and the different ideas and movements of that time. So, you know, ever since I was a kid. So this kind of project really allowed me to dive into that world, and I ended up through it kind of reliving the 1960s on maybe textually only, but in a sense it was the coming together of the realization of a dream of living in the 60s that I've had for many years in my life. And it's funny you should mention, by the way, the Israeli psychedelic experience, because right now one of the offshoots of this whole project is that I think the world is becoming more and more interested in these questions of psychedelics and culture, and of also looking beyond the American perspective. So this book kind of provides an American perspective on the on psychedelia, of course adding to many other works that use an American perspective. But right now I'm actually in the process of writing a history of Israeli psychedelia. So I'm kind of going through the process of, you know, starting to being part of a larger project that I think other people are also getting into now, of producing these more nationally oriented histories of psychedelia that are much in line of what I try to do in the book.
Well, that's fascinating, and it leads, you know, right perfectly into my next question, which was to unpack your title. Why is this an American trip? As you just said, you're writing a new work on the history of Israeli psychedelia. Psychedelics are used worldwide, aren't they? So why focus specifically on an American trip?
So, right, sure. I mean, psychedelics are used worldwide and have been used worldwide for centuries and millennia. But one of the key ideas in the book is the idea that the psychedelic experience is highly malleable, and that the effects of psychedelics are deeply shaped by the culture they're embedded in. So it's difficult to speak of a universal psychedelic experience. And that's one of the ways in which the book kind of challenges some of the common wisdoms, I think, or some of the assumptions that exist around psychedelics, around this idea of the psychedelic experience, this kind of universal entity, objective entity that exists in the world. And what I try to show in the book, also by comparing the American experience to experiences from other cultures, is how each culture and each subculture tends to produce its own kind of psychedelic experience with distinct features. So the American psychedelic experience is different from the French trip, or from the Shipibo trip, or from the Israeli trip, and even the American trip, the American psychedelic experience, tends to shift and change with the decades. And so this is why the book is primarily dedicated to the case of psychedelics in the mid-20th century. And it's trying to create a sort of relativization of the psychedelic experience, or just trying to show that we need to speak about psychedelic experience as something that's also embedded in its time and place, and that's why it's called American Trip.
Mm-hmm.
And let me add to that the idea of the American Trip was also based on this one recurring notion that you read across many of the discussions about the 1960s decade, this idea that the American society had this, the 1960s were like this sort of trip, and that the entire American society went through this experience in the 1960s that was very dramatic, very intensive, very intense, that was much like a trip. So I try to look at this idea, take it literally, take it seriously in the book, and ask what kind of trip was that? How did the external factors shape that trip? And really kind of give I would say kind of a biography of that collective trip, of the American trip of the 60s. That's that may be the most iconic trip in the history of psychedelia.
Isn't that great? I love it when authors find the perfect title for their work that essentially summarizes everything that it is they're trying to grapple with in their work. And I think American Trip is an ideal title for this work. And it's so nice to hear you really unpack it and tell us exactly what you're referring to, the multitude of things that you're referring to with these two little words. But your subtitle is also really interesting. So your subtitle is Set, Setting, and the Psychedelic Experience in the 20th Century. You've already talked quite a bit about the 20th century aspect of this. You're focusing primarily on the 60s, although you talk about the 1950s as well. But before we talk more about time, there are those two words, set and setting. I was wondering if you could tell us what you mean by set and setting and why these concepts are so important when you're discussing the psychedelic experience.
Sure. So set and setting is this idea that's very central to psychedelic theory and to psychedelic practice, and something that not only professionals know, but also a lot of lay people that or anybody interested in psychedelics. And it's been around since the 60s. And what it basically says it is that the experience of a psychedelic trip depends first and foremost on two types of factors. First on the set, and that's all of the internal psychological factors like the expectation, the intention, the mood of the person when they're going into the experience. And then the second kind of factors are the setting, and that refers to all the environmental factors like where you are, who you're with, what your culture tells you about these experiences. And so based on these kinds of contextual factors, the experience can go in many different directions and radically different directions. So the psychedelic experience for this reason can be extremely beautiful or extremely harrowing, scary, scarring. It can be heavenly, it can be hellish, and that depends on the kind of context that you have for the experience. And of course, context is always important to whatever experience we have in the world. Our expectations and intentions and the social environment are always important no matter where we go. But they tend to be even more crucial in the case of psychedelics because, and that's a key point about psychedelics, this idea that the word psychedelic actually means mind manifesting, right? That's the translation. And you have this idea of psychedelics as amplifiers of experience. So they're kind of they have this tendency to intensify the experience. So in that state, all of these contextual factors become enlarged and they become much more crucial, so that really any passing anxiety can become a full-blown paranoia, or otherwise just a pleasant view can become a wholly ecstatic or epiphanous experience. And in the case of psychiatric research of the mid-20th century, you really see how that came into place and how different groups worked under different kinds of sets and settings really produced very different kinds of results. And you had, for example, some groups of researchers that were working under the idea that these drugs produce psychosis, and they were giving them to people and telling them, you know, you will take this drug and you will go mad for a couple of hours. And these people had, not the best kind of introduction before taking a drug generally. Yeah. And they would have this experience in a hospital room and, you know, surrounded by psychiatrists or people that they don't know, that often behaved quite impersonally. They would have to go through these very exhausting batteries of tests. So obviously a lot of these people had really awful experiences, and this then shaped the kinds of conclusions that these researchers were making about these substances, while actually these were just reflections of the kinds of environments that they were creating. And on the other hand, you would have other groups of researchers that would have their subjects that would tell them, you know, this drug will make you more creative or more spiritual. It will help you work through your problems. And they would have them spend their time in a comfortable, beautifully set space, listening to records and being there with a therapist or with friends, with a lot of support. So very different kinds of experiences, and the setting is so important, because that really stands at the basis of the central argument, which is about this malleability, about this multiplicity of psychedelic effects, and how they depend on context and the broader implication that this dependency has.
Yeah, absolutely. The context and the power of suggestion seem so important and so powerful when discussing the psychedelic experience. But the setting specifically, I think, is also a really interesting question, because you set your American trip, your book, in the mid-20th century. And I think to many people, psychedelics seem like something from the 1960s writ large, sort of in the cultural imagination, which usually means the late 1960s into the 1970s, when the hippies were at their zenith, and there's this, imagination of Haight-Ashbury and San Francisco and Woodstock and all these other things. But you don't focus only on that period. You actually take readers back to an earlier period as well, discussing the 1950s and early 60s. Why were psychedelics so important during the mid-20th century? And how did they emerge into the American consciousness at this time? Were they available prior to the 1950s, or did they only really emerge mid-century?
Right, so I focus on the 1950s and 60s. Psychedelics became more culturally present, I guess, in the late 1960s and early 1970s. But the story of psychedelic research, and really the moment in which these drugs made their advent the culture and into science, and where their very diverse types of potentialities became known, was already in the 1950s, which was the heyday of psychedelic research, the 1950s and the early days, the early 1960s, because later on, actually by the time that these things really got to become more popular and more popularized and publicized, they were already kind of over with as a scientific enterprise, or the psychedelic research was already running into a lot of trouble, and the psychedelics were were, you know, they were known to some degree in since the 19th century. And of course, you had anthropologists going and eating mescaline with native tribes. And you have William James, father of American psychology, who also had an experience with mescaline. But really, all of this changed when psychedelics, when LSD arrived at the scene, which happened in the early 1950s. And that was the case, I think, for several reasons. And one of them, a crucial one, was that LSD was just so much more active than and potent than other psychedelics, so that just 1 gram of LSD was enough to dose 10,000 people. And this was this turned this this substance into something that could be argued to have immense significance, in the sense that it's might be indicative of processes that we have in the brain, and that's part of the reason why psychiatrists became so fascinated with this drug in the early 50s. And then were just other cultural reasons that that ended up being the real reasons why psychedelics became that central in the late 50s and early 1960s, just as American culture was going through this new phase of opening up after McCarthyism and trying new paths in art and in the culture and in therapy, and all of these alternative movements were kind of simmering, where LSD and other psychedelics could really attach to quite well and become the seeds of the kind of cultural revolution that they ended up fomenting.
Right. Tell us a little bit more about LSD specifically. How is it different from other psychedelics like psilocybin or mescaline? You said it's more powerful, but is it different in other ways? And how did it make its way to America? Was it, I don't believe it was discovered in the United States, was it? So how did it come over here?
Right, so LSD was discovered by Albert Hofmann in 1943, and one of the key thing that really made it so extraordinary, as I've mentioned, is its potency. Because Hofmann, the famous story is that he was trying this compound that he, after having a strange sensation a few days earlier while synthesizing it, and he thought, that thing might be psychoactive, and he tried an amount that he thought would under no circumstances be active. It turned out to be a huge dose, and LSD was, and he ended up having this epic bike ride back home that celebrated every year to this day on what's today known as Bicycle Day on the 19th of April. And so LSD was just the idea that 100 micrograms, and the microgram is 1/1,000,000th of a gram, were enough to send a person to a different reality, was something that was quite extraordinary at the time, almost unbelievable. And when Hofmann first reported these results, people at his firm were actually quite skeptical of that, and asking to revisit his conclusions. And as I said, the idea that the thing that made LSD as interesting and as radical as it was thought to be was that it was thought as psychosis mimicking agent, as a psychotomimetic, something that induces psychosis. And psychiatrists had this idea for a long time that you have that psychosis might be caused by some kinds of mental of a psychochemical imbalance or some kind of substance that's being secreted by the brain. But with mescaline, for instance, there was this hypothesis could never really take off because mescaline was only active above a certain range that you should have been able to find in the brain of a patient after he passes away. So in that sense, you could argue that if we don't find it there, then it's probably false. But with LSD, the idea was that if such minuscule amounts of this substance are enough to cause what people then consider as psychosis-inducing effects, then really this drug could be the key to unlocking the secrets of psychosis. And if we could experimentally produce psychosis, then we might also be able to learn how to stop it, to how to neutralize these kinds of substances and solve the whole problem of schizophrenia and psychosis, which was the original promise that people saw in LSD in the early days of LSD research.
Right. So it's incredibly appealing, not necessarily to members of the counterculture at first. And of course, the counterculture is still quite nascent in the 1950s and early 1960s, but powerful, but unique and intriguing to a different group of individuals, some of whom are quite powerful as far as the government is concerned. So you, in your introduction, you say that you don't offer a tidy story in American Trip, which makes a lot of sense to me as a drug historian myself. The phrase I most often employ when discussing any kind of story about drug use and policy is that it's complicated. But you do organize your book around five LSD researchers and seven visions of LSD that, as you write, collectively make up the plurality of psychedelic identity during the mid-20th century. Now, I already knew some of these five people, like Timothy Leary, but others were new to me. So who are the five people that you write about, and why did you choose them?
Right, so there are five main figures, as you said, and they're kind of overlapping with the different schools, the seven schools of LSD research that I look at in the book. And, choosing to have these figures to really have something to identify with or really look closer on and having some kind of a live example of these kinds of cultural tendencies and trends was something that helped bring more depth and just the possibility of humanization to the story. And each of these figures is quite different from the rest. So the first one is Max Trinkl, who was a German psychiatrist who emigrated to the US and became the first investigator to work with LSD in the States. And he pushed that idea of LSD as a psychotic mimetic compound, as I mentioned, a compound that induces psychosis. He had a tremendous impact on that whole movement, the experimental psychosis movement. And although this kind, and he was also important in his in being one, among the first to write about the importance of extra pharmacological factors in shaping the effects of LSD or of sense setting, though he didn't call it that, and he didn't really take his conclusions to the last point of realizing how he himself was actually shaping the effects of LSD as he was conducting his experiments. And that's why he eventually did fall into the trap of identifying LSD as an essentially psychotomimetic drug without realizing that it's a broader story than that. The second researcher I look at is Sidney Cohen, who was a psychiatrist at UCLA School of Medicine. And he became intrigued about psychedelics after having an experience with LSD and finding that it actually did not have the kind of effect that he was expecting, which was he came into the experience expecting a psychotomimetic experience. So he was expecting to have this harrowing experience of psychosis, but it turned out to be something very different and quite beautiful. So that made him curious, and he started to run studies on LSD, trying to find out if it could have a therapeutic effect. And this is where my third figure enters, which is Betty Eisner, who was a psychologist that Cohen invited into his team and put in charge of optimizing the set and the setting in his experiments in order to achieve the best results. And it was really nice also to write about Eisner, because she's not a very well-known figure, but she's one of the earliest researchers to write about the idea of using contextual elements or a sentence setting to optimize psychedelic experiences. And in that sense, she's kind of a mother figure to a lot of what later came on in the world of psychedelic therapy and to this day. And she was also an only woman in the world of men. And in many of these conferences, you know, you would have these 30 males in the picture and Betty Eisner as the only one. So it was... So it was nice to kind of redeem her story and show how also the very significant influence that she also had on this development of the idea of sense setting.
Right, replacing that pioneer back into the story. I think that's an incredibly important contribution that this book makes. So as a woman, I appreciate you're telling the story of Betty Eisner and putting her back into the tale.
And the interesting thing also, when I'm looking at Cohen and Eisner, and they're two separate figures, though they're involved in the same kind of research, but they eventually part ways. And this parting of ways is also interesting in a way, because Eisner became more and more enthused with psychedelics, with spiritual ideas like cosmic consciousness and reincarnations, while Cohen at the same time became increasingly critical of psychedelic research and published some of the most influential early papers on the risks of psychedelics. So they eventually went separate ways. And then I have the as a fourth figure, I have the figure of Timothy Leary, who's of course much better known than all of my other figures. And he was a Harvard psychology professor that became interested in psychedelics and quickly became immersed in this world and became this kind of LSD evangelist that got kicked out of Harvard, had run-ins with the law, and eventually became a symbol for the entire psychedelic counterculture, and also a scapegoat for not only for the American government, but to this day to psychedelic scientists and that often blame him for the entire for the entire sad tale of what happened to psychedelic research later on, which is often blamed on Leary and his very extravagant and flamboyant character and behavior.
Yes.
And then the fifth and last one is Myron Stolaroff, who was a very successful electrical engineer with an interest in personal development. And he became interested in LSD in the early 1960s. He founded the International Foundation of Advanced Studies, which worked from Palo Alto, in the area that later became known as Silicon Valley. And that whole chapter is called Psychedelics Go to Silicon Valley. And it's about the use of psychedelics for technological innovation. He had a group that was composed mainly of engineers and other technical people, and their most famous project was one where they gave LSD and mescaline to groups of scientists and engineers and technicians that were stuck solving professional problems and trying to find out if psychedelics could contribute to technological innovation. And it turned out that they could. It was only a pilot study, but it led to many breakthroughs for these people and to patents and to products. So that's really one experiment that I think would be very interesting to repeat in this newer wave of psychedelic renaissance that we're currently going through.
Yeah, imagine what our iPhones could become if people at Apple were given more psychedelics exactly. to work through their professional challenges, right? That's great. So you also then focus on what you call seven visions of LSD and its users. What do you mean by this phrase? And which seven visions did you focus on?
Right, so seven visions of LSD and its users, that's seven distinct visions that existed in the 1950s and 1960s in these different researcher groups or user groups about what LSD is and what's the proper way to use it. So you had at the time different groups working with very different assumptions and ideas about what this drug does and reporting and creating very different kinds of sets and settings in terms of what kinds of expectations and intentions they were creating in their subjects and what kind of environments they were creating for them, what kinds of activities they asked them to take part in. So these seven groups, I describe them as microclimates of seven settings. So thinking about the entire American society as the seven setting for the grander American trip, and then in the books that go that describe these seven visions of LSD, I go into these microclimates of smaller subgroups or subcultures that were interested in creating or achieving specific effects from these substances. And the first group is the psychedelic group that I've already mentioned. A second group was the military and the CIA, who were interested in using psychedelics in battle as incapacitating agents or for torture or for special operations, like slipping LSD into Castro's teacup before he's about to give a speech and embarrass himself. So that's a second line of research. The third one is the psychotherapeutic one that we're also that's I guess today the most well known and the most prominent in the world of psychedelics. He uses psychedelics in psychotherapy and in psychiatry more generally. Then you have the fourth school that was about the spiritual use of LSD, the use of LSD to induce mystical experiences. And you, of course, have the very famous Good Friday experiment that Timothy Leary ran in the early 1960s, where he gave psilocybin to a group of divinity students with another group that did not get any of the psilocybin and produced for the first time this result that showed quite unequivocally that LSD, the psilocybin and psychedelics are quite able to induce very powerful spiritual experiences, something that was, of course, widely known throughout cultures throughout the years. But, you know, that was the first time that it was shown scientifically. And in the new wave of psychedelic research, that was also one of the first results to become replicated by the Johns Hopkins team that ended up doing a 2006 study showing how psychedelics induce mystical experiences and corroborated that earlier research. So this question was more or less decided later in the decade when psychedelics really entered the cultural scene. And you had people like the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix and Pink Floyd and psychedelic poster art really coming into the cultural scene. And at that point, it was already decided for the culture that psychedelics are this kind of cultural stimulant that everybody became interested in. And by the end of the 60s, you already had like groups, like Motown groups, like the Temptations, interested in doing psychedelic music, quote unquote. The sixth group is the tech innovation group that I discussed earlier, so I won't get into that. And the seventh and last one is the use of psychedelics for political reasons. So in the 1950s, that was mostly about the use of psychedelics for peace building. And we have reports about LSD sessions being run in the UN with the UN members and heads of states and ministers. And in the late 1960s, that became more about the radicalizing effects of LSD, using LSD to raise political consciousness in the left, in revolutionary groups, and eventually leading all the way to the more radicalized guerrilla warfare of groups like the Weather Underground, who were deeply involved with LSD and saw it as kind of a tool to awaken the political consciousness of their members.
Right. I feel like there's a growing understanding in some realms of the role that LSD has played on a governmental level. For example, I feel like Americans have a growing understanding of the MK Ultra experiments in the 1960s. And I'm thinking too of Stephen Kinzer's new book, Poisoner in Chief, which is about Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA's search for mind control. So we're starting to understand a little bit more about the interest the federal government and the military had in this substance, and for kind of a one might say, you know, somewhat suggestive uses. But your book, I feel like, does a really nice job of expanding our understanding of how these visions of LSD, what it could do, what it could achieve, was used for both nefarious and very powerful and oftentimes very positive outcomes as well. But your book as a whole is 10 chapters long. And as you're kind of going through those seven visions, they line up in some ways with the first seven chapters, which sort of provide a historical overview, moving through LSD research in the 50s and 60s and exploring the role that set and setting played in each of these instances. But in your last three chapters, you also analyze the ways in which LSD interacts with American society. You say that there is a deep sense of cultural embeddedness of psychedelics. I really like that phrase, and that these drugs have a culturally dependent nature. So what do you mean by the cultural embeddedness of psychedelics? How have psychedelics like LSD interacted with American society, and how does American society interact, or has it interacted with psychedelics?
Right. So when you look at the story of psychedelics in the 1960s, you can see that a lot of the things that LSD and psychedelics were assumed to do, and a lot of the qualities that were ascribed to them, were actually, in a sense, a reflection of the preoccupations of American society at the time and of different cultural trends that just became kind of attached to the story of psychedelics. So, for example, in the 1960s, the psychedelic experience was highly sexualized, and you had people like Timothy Leary telling readers of Playboy that a woman on LSD will have hundreds of orgasms in one session. And you had these books like The Sexual Paradise of LSD, and you had this general idea that LSD opens the gate to a new world of liberated polymorphous sexuality of the kind that writers like Herbert Marcuse were talking about, a multidimensional sexuality, a kind of utopian eroticism. When you look at it from a cross-cultural perspective, you find that really it does this kind of assumption about psychedelics being sexual enhancers is quite foreign to a lot of the traditional uses of psychedelics. In shamanic uses, sex is a big no-no, and actually you're supposed to be sexually abstinent for a very long time to get anywhere with your initiation with psychedelics. And you can see that actually the whole sexual connection was really related to the sexual revolution of the 1960s and to the fact that psychedelics were mostly used by these very young people that were into free love. Though that became later assumed to be, or at the time it was assumed to be quite a central aspect of the effects of these drugs, and you can see that in other instances, for example, psychedelics were thought to be something that makes you question authority, that makes you think for yourself, that make people instinctively rebellious and anti-war, anti-money, anti-psychiatry, anti-whatever. And this is one of the oft-repeated maxims of psychedelic culture. And Terence McKenna, who was one of the leading psychedelic thinkers of the 80s and 90s, he said it best when he said, you know, if it doesn't matter if you're a Hasidic rabbi or a Marxist-Leninist or a rationalist scientist, psychedelics will make you question your worldview. And then you look at these other societies where psychedelics are used traditionally, and you find that actually their psychedelics are not used to question or destabilize social norms, but on the contrary, they're used to instill the values of the society and to enhance the social cohesion. So they don't enhance the generation gap. They're seen as a generational bridge, and they're not a countercultural technology, they're a pro-cultural technology. And the reason that they became so associated with this rebelliousness, individualism, in American society of the mid-20th century was really, again, because of this whole phenomena of the counterculture that became associated with psychedelics, and that was so much about this non-conformism. So those are just two examples of ways in which these broader cultural trends intervened to kind of shape how people approached and thought about these substances in ways that later also changed the experience of the experiences of people, changed the expectations, the intentions, and the kind of the whole scene and discourse around these agents.
Right. It's like it's the question of the chicken and the egg in the 1960s. What came first, LSD or anti-authoritarian attitudes?
Absolutely.
And, you know, both were sort of feeding off of each other and emboldening each other. That's fascinating. One of the other arguments that you make is that the role of set and setting should be considered when making drug policy. And I think this is a really, really intriguing idea. How could America craft better drug laws with these concepts in mind?
Right. So one of the stories that I talk about in the book is based on a paper by this sociologist Richard Bunce, published in the 1970s, where Bunce looked at the growing rate of bad trips in the late 1960s. And he argued that had to do with this environment of paranoia and a deep suspicion of psychedelics that the American government was was advocating or supporting at the time. And so we can see that these kinds of anti-drug campaigns or the kinds of attitudes that governments and society at large creates around mind-altering experiences can really have a deep influence about how people approach these substances. And again, it's very different if you approach them from a Western perspective of, I don't know, getting hammered or just trying to wipe out your brain. I'm giving these very extreme examples, but of course, Western society has had a very troubled relationship with mind-altering experiences, and it achieves very different kinds of results than, say, the kinds of experiences that people have often in traditional societies, where they're used as part of in a ritualistic setting as something that's meaningful. So when our society, when the state or when our government tells us that these substances are wrong, that the people using them are bad people, that when they're really distorting information about them to make them seem more scary or dangerous. And you know, people talk about fake news today, but in the 1960s, the American government was spreading loads of fake news about psychedelics, you know, that they're causing chromosome damage. People were worried at the time that they would have mutant kids because the government was telling them that, and that it fries their brain and all sorts of stuff. So when you have all of these things and they're actually causing real harm, so I would argue that rather than going on this anti-drug crusades that actually end up creating these fear-based environments where people are much likelier to experience anxiety and experience just distress, we do better if we want to minimize harms and maybe even maximize benefits. If we think about the kinds of tools that we give to people in our society and think about drug education, real drug education, in the sense of teaching people about the effects, the dangers and the potential benefits, or just, you know, the positive sides, because there are some positive effects that the drugs have, otherwise people wouldn't use them. So so if people got an honest kind of education that really allowed them to approach psychoactive substances in a way that's more fruitful and not based on just on kind of state produced fear and ignorance.
Well, I wish I had confidence to say that the American government would not produce anti-drug propaganda, but I don't know if that'll ever be the case. But there are certain areas in the U.S. that do seem to be listening to your argument. Denver, Colorado had decriminalized the possession of psilocybin mushrooms a year or two ago. Listeners can give me the exact date later in their comments. But where I live in Washington, D.C., we're actually letting residents vote on decriminalizing the possession of what are referred to as psychedelic plant medicines next week during the presidential election on November 3rd. Up the street in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University, researchers are studying the very positive and beneficial effects of psychedelics on treating things like PTSD and depression. So what are your thoughts on this renewed interest in the medical benefits of psychedelia? And what can the history of the 1960s tell us about our current moment? Can it warn us away from anything? And can it direct us in the right direction?
Right. So, first of all, it's an incredible moment to be alive these days as somebody interested in psychedelics or as a psychedelic researcher, because really everything that's happening today is kind of science fiction to anyone that was interested in these agents 15 or 20 years ago. There was just nowhere on the horizon that these things would come back from being a complete taboo. Blamed for all the evils of the world into becoming something that the FDA designates as breakthrough treatment and that receives investor interest and that's being publicized very positively across the press and really the medicalized the medicalization of psychedelics definitely helped a great deal and in achieving that new status, and psychedelic research in that sense followed maybe on the footsteps of the medicalization of cannabis and how that also changed public approach to marijuana.
Yes, the history does seem, I noticed that when I was reading your book, I thought the history of medical marijuana in the 1990s seems very parallel to the medicalization of psychedelics today and how that it has increased the social embrace of these drugs now that they are no longer considered anathema, but potential panaceas for problems and diseases and illnesses and traumas that otherwise don't have really effective medications. We're going back to essentially these plant medicines that that had been, as you said, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, were considered the boogeymen of American culture, that they were responsible for everything wrong that had gone on. And now we're looking at these substances as potential benefits and healers for problems that we don't otherwise know how to address. It is a fascinating transformation that is led by recognition of the medical benefits that had been so long denied for decades.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, if we look at the story of the 1960s, we can see that so many of these seven visions that I describe in the book are back now. And you know, it started with the medicalized, but we also have more and more interest in the creative side, also the technical side. The psychodynamic research is still active, and we have these days research going on here in Israel, for example, of bringing together Israelis and Palestinians to drink ayahuasca. So we also have the wow. political aspect. Yeah. So except for the CIA, I think everybody are back on board. And I don't know about the CIA, maybe they're too, but they're not letting anyone know.
There'll be a book about it in 50 years. Well, then we'll know.
Very possible. But I think that at the same time, we're also seeing new strains of discussions and roles that are appearing, and you know, and ways in which psychedelics also reflect the current set and setting. So there's a lot more talk of using psychedelics to increase everyday functioning and productivity, such as in the discourse about microdosing in the office by people in creative industry and so on and so forth. There's a lot more discussions around the subject of identity, which is quite, of course, in tune with the times and with the concerns and discourse of our time. And there's also a lot of concern about the commercialization of this culture and the co-optation of psychedelia by corporations. That's quite also that's arriving together with concerns about medicalization and the concern that the medical vision wants to kind of overrun the other ones, or that there's a risk that it might overrun the other potentialities. And that's really, for me, this book is in a sense a love song to LSD and its plurality of possibilities and its multiplicity. And in that sense, I would like, as somebody who's interested in these substances, to not see any one school, not the spiritual, not the medical, not the creative, reach a kind of hegemony. And the story of the 60s teaches us really that psychedelics have the ability to really kind of transform and take on whatever it is that we're throwing at them. So we need to be aware of the kinds of ideas and notions that we're letting, that we're using as we're letting these agents back into society, and be aware that the kind of cultural setting that we have around us, that we're creating, has the potential of shaping how the effects of these drugs are later manifested in the society. So it's a call basically for self-reflection, also on a social and cultural level, about not just taking these agents as already sorry about that.
Right, it's like, yeah, because, as you said, the definition of psychedelic is mind manifestation, right? If psychedelics reveal what is already inside of us, we have to be somewhat careful if we're going to open this Pandora's box, because we have to be aware of, we should probably know before going into it too deep what it is that we're going to find. I do deeply hope that they would be responsible for world peace as opposed to World War III. But I think you're right. What your research has shown, and what your emphasis on setting points out, is how distinctly important it is that we understand that psychedelics don't bring something new to the table. They reveal what's already inside of us, for good or for ill. And I think that's a really critical component when discussing the future legal, spiritual, artistic, and medical understandings of how we use these drugs.
Right, and they can open also so many new possibilities, and they can lead the way to so many paths of development. But all of this is always dependent on the kinds of environments that we create for really this experimentation. And as you said, it can lead in many directions, and as very valuable tools, we need to be aware that we're able to use or misuse them, and it matters how we approach them, not only as individuals, but also as societies and cultures.
Right. So it's up to us. It's a lot of responsibility.
Absolutely.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time on this absolutely fascinating conversation. But before we let you go, I'd love to know what you're working on now. What is your next project?
Right. There's so many books that I want to write, and I have a list of several dozens that I'm hoping to write someday.
Wow, several dozens?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know if they're all that great, but at least the idea is there. And but if you've got to choose, choose one. You can't write them all. And there's this one book that I really want to get to writing, which is kind of a continuation and a remake of my first book, Techno Mystica. And that's because my first published book, which was published in Hebrew in 2009, which was about media ecology, about how different media environments shape consciousness, shape our experience in the world. I talk not only about digital media and how things like a smartphone or a computer shape your experience or shape consciousness, but also drugs and nutrition and urban landscapes and garments. And as I was approaching the end of American trip, I realized that I was actually writing my first book all over again, only with a different emphasis, because Set and Setting is all about how these environments shape our awareness and consciousness. Only with Set and Setting, the focus is on psychedelics and how that happens within a psychedelic experience. So in a sense, I'd like to go back and revisit that original hunch that I had in Technomystica and try to produce a more informed, mature version, this time in English. And that's informed by this whole excursion into the idea of sense setting and the theory of sense setting, and also by the idea of ideas of media ecology that's a theoretical school, and create a kind of guide to media environments and how they shape our minds, which is a very grand project, but I like grand projects.
Well, when it's released, I look forward to talking about it with you here on the New Books Network. So thank you so much. I really want to thank you for being on this show today. I've absolutely enjoyed our conversation. I encourage everyone to pick up a copy of American Trip, especially if you live in areas where psychedelics might be legalized or decriminalized soon. Bone up on the history of this. And thank you so much, Ido. Really an enjoyable conversation, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.